So darling, darling. Are you there, Morgan?
I'm here.
Stand by me. Welcome, everybody. We are almost to the finish line on what has been an amazing series of Black History Boot Camp, where we have been breaking down the most powerful crews in Black history. We are on day 18. This is a 21-day series, and I'm happy to welcome everybody who's calling in from all over the world, especially and doubly, especially the people who actually lace up their sneakers and walk with us on these conversations. Thank you for being with us on this journey. We hope you are inspired and enjoying the stories. I am Vanessa. I'm one of your walk leaders for today, and I'm walking in Washington, D.C., and I am joined by Morgan, who's walking. Where are you walking today, Morgan?
In my neighborhood. I'm in Ghana. Yeah.
Morgan, how much do you know about our today's subject, which is the Sojourners for Truth and Justice?
Nothing. Zero. I don't even know how to say the name. So I don't even know anything about it. I don't know what year it was in. I don't know anything. So I'm looking forward to it.
Okay, I love it. Well, I love that we're going to talk about them today. I do want to note that we started the call with Tracy Chapman, Stand By Me. And I chose that song, Morgan, because of the Black women who not only we're going to learn about today who organized for justice, but also for the Black women who they organized on behalf of, whose names we will never know. And I was just like, once you know the story, you'll understand, but it's so powerful. We just be showing up for each other in this way that Black women, it's like sometimes it feels like we're all we got. And Morgan and I were just talking about this today and in terms of our crews, Morgan, and how essential and important it is for us to build this safe space where women just feel like they have a place to go, a person to go to. And that's what these crews are all about. So I love that song. I hope y'all all do. Shout out to Tracy Chapman. Please let her know that Girl Trek loves her. Somebody who's out there.
Oh, I love that song. It was kind of sad. And it's like, it's been a heck of a day for me. It's been a doozy of a day. It was kind of a sad song. I was like, dang, Z, this where we going? This where we going in today?
We're going there because actually we're gonna start with the story of Harry and Harriet Moore. And it is a sad story. All of our stories are going to end triumphantly, y'all, like it has been written in the books, but this part of the story is sad. And so actually it was really even the energy of the story. And that's okay because, you know, our stories are sad and triumphant and traumatizing and all sorts of things. So, yes.
Oh, that's wonderful.
We're going to start today's conversation in the 1930s, Morgan. And we're going to start the conversation talking about a dynamic and amazing Black couple. Their names are Harry and Harriet Moore. And they began organizing in the 1930s for the NAACP in Central Florida. They launched a legal struggle that eventually won equal pay for Black and white teachers. A little bit to our conversation yesterday, they were fierce organizers, a married couple. And in 1941, Harry became the president and later the executive director of the Florida State NAACP. And under his leadership, he was one of the most successful NAACP executive directors. They grew down there in Central Florida to more than 10,000 members and over 60 branches across the state. This was at the exact same time that in 1944, Thurgood Marshall, who was sitting on the Supreme Court, won a landmark case, Smith versus Allwright, that ruled that all white primary elections were unconstitutional. And Harry and Harriet, who were organizing for the NAACP, were really able to take advantage of that ruling and mobilize people in their states. So we know, though, that with Black people now allowed to vote in real elections, that the heat got really hot. And we've talked about this a lot in terms of the KKK, in terms of the codes and the rules that were trying to keep people and restricting them from actually voting. And yet the Moores, Harry and Henrietta Morgan, they managed to register over 100,000 Black voters, the two of them as a couple. And they increased Black registration from 5% to 31% of the eligible voters in their city. I mean, across
Wow.
Florida.
Wow, that's more than Daniel Tamer.
I know. I was like,
in Mississippi. We should know their names. What are their names again?
Harry and Harrietta Moore. And sorry, Harry and Harriet.
That's hilarious.
But Harriet's name was spelled like Harriet. Yes, I know it is hilarious. It kind of want me a man whose name is like something like my name. Harriet Moore was a sixth grade teacher at George. This like educators are just boss. So she was a teacher by day and an NAACP organizer by night. And her husband was the executive director. And Morgan on their silver.
Like
Septima Clark.
Yeah, so many of those black teachers we talked about yesterday became the organizers of the South. But Septima Clark was, she got fired from her teaching job for being the secretary of the NAACP. Y'all, we didn't even share the good news with y'all. The NASA emailed us, and when we talked about Septima Clark, in our second TED Talk, we talked about Septima Clark. One of the scientists from NASA heard about this powerful, powerful architect of the civil rights movement. And they were, and she was so inspired that she named a, what was it, a star, a galaxy? She named
an asteroid.
She named an asteroid after Septima Clark. Y'all, listen, our ancestors are shining down on us in many ways. And that's just one of them. Thank you, NASA, for recognizing our foremother, Septima Clark. But yeah, no, that reminds me of her. But keep going. So I like how you dropped that in there.
Yeah. NASA was watching our TED Talk and they got inspired by our TED Talk to go ahead and name an asteroid after the one and only Septima Clark and send us a letter confirming it. I like how you dropped that.
That's so bomb. Yeah, that was so bomb. It's so good. But I forgot we told our crew that, the people who walk with us. So that's so good. But okay. So Harriet and Harry Moore in Florida registered 100,000 people to vote. NAACP, I'm tracking. Here we go. What else?
They were living in Mims, Florida, Morgan, and it was Christmas Day, and they were celebrating their silver anniversary when a bomb set by the Ku Klux Klan blew up their house. Harry Moore died on the way to the hospital. That's why I feel like I'm going to cry saying this. God, our people have just been through so much. Harry Moore died on the way to the hospital, and Harriet Moore died 9 days later in the hospital. And I start there with that story because it was a group of black women, the Sojourners for Truth and Justice, and I'll tell you all about who they were and how they were formed in a minute, who responded to that death with a press release. And in the press release, Morgan, they talked about the mothers of Harry and Harriet. And they said that black women the world over know far too well the grief that their mothers, their one of their mother's name was Rosa, and I don't know what the other mother's name was, that what they were experiencing, and that they had birthed these two great people into the world who were doing great work, and they were like, and they said Harriet's mother, who was 71 years old at the time, sat by her daughter's dying bedside for those 9 days. And they said that this action pierced through the side of every Negro mother. And they argue that the tragedy was an example of the daily experience that black women specifically are experiencing. Not even just in, they were saying it is the death and the violence that they directly experience, but they were saying, and as mothers, these are our sons and these are our daughters, and this isn't okay. And I loved that their message wasn't just talking about the murders and the injustice of the Ku Klux Klan, but that they wanted to bring in the mothers. And I know we have like the mothers of the movement now, we have Say Her Name, and we have so many conversations that are happening, but this is in the 1940s where these women were like, black women and our struggles and what we are experiencing, we want to talk about and organize just like Girl Trek is doing, unapologetically around the experiences of black women. The case of Harriet and Harriet Moore was only one of the high profile cases that they were using to highlight what was happening with black women in this country. There was another high profile case, Morgan, of a woman named Rosa Lee Ingram. She was a Georgia sharecropper, and she was sentenced to death for killing her white landlord who was raping her. And the Sojourner, she was arrested and convicted. And the Sojourners for Truth and Justice were, it was one of the first causes where they came together and they were like, what is it that we do for this Black woman? And they were attempting to organize something called the March on Georgia, which they weren't able to do, but they were able to do some other stuff. But it was because they were looking around and saying that all of the movements that were budding up at this time were focused on community broadly or Black men intentionally, but that Black women were being left out of the conversation. So the question becomes, who are these women and how did they have the organizing might and ability to, which we'll talk about in a second, in 1951, they traveled here to Washington, D.C., and they met with several people of the White House, and it included Lorraine Hansberry and a bunch of, and Louise Thompson Patterson, Mary Church Terrell, and a bunch of prominent Black women. So that's the story that we're going to tell today, the story of how the Sojourners for Truth and Justice was founded and the women behind it. But I wanted to start with the work that they were doing and their framework for elevating the specific issues that Black women were facing. Their who's who, Morgan, of who was in the Sojourners for Truth and Justice, I know for a fact you're going to know these names. As I call them out, just say yes or no if you know who was a part of this. Do you know who Alice Childress is?
Nope.
Good. We're going to. Do you know who Shirley DuBois is?
Mm-mm. I don't know none of the people in that email.
Yes, you do.
Oh,
okay.
No, I don't.
Okay. Shirley DuBois is W. E. B. DuBois' wife.
Oh, I kind of know her. Okay.
Okay. Do you? Yeah, this is the last. This is the last name I'm going to say. Do you know who Louise Thompson Patterson is?
Vanessa.
She was once married to Wallace Thurman. Okay. Okay. No, this is good. I like it. I like it. Let's get into it. Okay.
I read the names. I don't know who these sisters are, and I, God willing, I will by the end of this walk. Okay.
Okay. So the Sojourners for Truth and Justice were a group of Black women, a very progressive group of Black women who envisioned a political movement that they understood race, gender, and class. They are considered essentially like the first pioneering Black leftist feminist group. The group was inspired by a poem that the actress Bay Richards, who was most known for her work in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. The Black actress who starred in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner answered the call at a Chicago conference for a poem, and the poem had a cash prize, and it was supposed
to
be the best.
Sorry, I'm over here cracking up. There's a Black lady in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. Wasn't it about a white lady bringing a Black man home?
It was, but there was a Black, I don't know. I just know that she was in, I know she was in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. If somebody knows who she was, maybe she played his mom, his somebody, but she was in the movie. Oh, she's been in a lot of other stuff. If you Google her face, you guys will see. But that was like the role that she was like one of those Black actresses who, if you see her face, you can be like, oh, she was in this, she was in that. She was in a lot of stuff. So she was an actress.
Okay. I got you.
There was a conference in Chicago, and they were asking for poets to submit their poems. The best poem about peace was going to win an award. And she submitted a poem called A Black Woman Speaks of White Womanhood, of White Supremacy, and of White Peace. And it's her poem that Leah Hurd, who was married to Wallace Thurman, Louise Thompson Patterson Hurd, she was at the conference. And she went up to Bea right after the conference. And she was like, I am so inspired by this poem. I want to use it as a framework to start this new political movement, which was the Sojourners for Truth and Justice. I actually have a snippet of the poem that we're going to play. It is such, her voice is just so rich and it's so beautiful. The poem is almost 4 or 5 minutes long. We're going to just listen to like 90 seconds of the poem. So if you guys can cue that up and play it, I just want to bring in Bay Richards' voice. And I want you to imagine that in the audience was this woman, Louise Thompson Patterson, who was so inspired by it. So let's play a little clip of her poem.
It is right that I, a woman Black, should speak of white womanhood. My husbands, my fathers, my brothers, my sons, die for it. They said, the white supremacists said, that you were better than me, that your fair brow should never know the sweat of slavery. They lied. white woman who too is enslaved. The difference is degree. They brought me here in chains. They brought you here, willing slaves to man. You bore him sons. I bore him sons. No, not willingly. He purchased you. He raped me. You were afraid to nurse your young. Lest fallen breasts offend your master's sight, and he should flee to firmer loveliness. And so, you pass them, your children, on to me. Flesh that was your flesh, blood that was your blood, drank the sustenance of life from me. And as I gave suck, I knew I nursed my own child's enemy.
That was a snippet from her performing the poem. We'll share the whole thing on Instagram, Morgan. It is so powerful. And it was considered to be one of the first kind of manifestos that moved the feminist movement towards a more intersectional framework, where Black women were like, what is happening in feminism right now is not about us, and we are not going to move forward in this feminist movement without actually level setting around what the experiences are. And it's why the Sojourners for Truth and Justice was in part named after Sojourner Truth, because they were continuing on that legacy that Sojourner Truth herself had started with her Ain't I a Woman, and they were bringing that to the forefront. And they themselves wrote a manifesto. And the manifesto started with a quote from Harriet Tubman. I'm going to keep on stinging until I arouse the consciousness of America. And then it includes a quote from Sojourner Truth. And they say, and it says, Sojourner is my name because I am going to travel up and down America and spread the truth. So that's what the Sojourners for Truth and Justice were doing. They were the very first group to be surveilled by Hoover's FBI, Morgan. And they were being surveilled by Hoover's FBI immediately once they started to organize for that Black woman who went on trial in Georgia for the murder of her white, the landlord who was trying to rape her. And there's all sorts of documents from the FBI where it shows that how they were specifically harassing the women as organizers of their march. And they were so fearful that they were going to come down there to Georgia and essentially mobilize people. And so Hoover started to surveil them. They had chapters all over. They started surveilling people's homes. They started going to their jobs. They started threatening them on the streets. A woman in California was just like, they physically attacked her. So they were really, really intimidating this group, this essentially Negroes women's movement, and defining them as a militant struggle. And the women said they were okay with being defined as a militant struggle because that's exactly what they were. In their manifesto, they wrote, and I was like, this feels so much like what we talk about in Girl Trek. Just a little snippet from their manifesto. It said, we die of poverty, loneliness, drudgery, and disease, Morgan. That's the first sentence. We die of poverty, loneliness, drudgery, and disease. We have watched our husbands and fathers burned, quartered, hanged, and electrocuted by hooded and unhooded mobs. We have seen our brothers beaten, shot, and stamped to death by police. And when our greatest fighter for civil rights dares to challenge the injustice, he is cursed, reviled, and indicted by the highest legislative body in the land. And they said, no more. We're going to organize. And so in 1951, they put a call to action out, and it said, Negro women of every city, town, and state, arise and come to D.C. because we are going to demand from the president, the Justice Department, the State Department, and the Congress absolute, immediate, and unconditional redress of grievances. They did not have a major large crowd that came, Morgan. But let me tell you about the women who did came. 140 women came, and it literally read like from education to activism to artists, it was the women who you wanted to be in a crew with you and in community on the ground. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about those women, because learning about them blew my absolute mind when we talk about like the details of so many stories that we've already told in Black History Bootcamp and how these women were behind so many of those stories already. The first of those women, Morgan, was a woman named Esther Cooper Jackson. She was an Alabama-based civil rights activist who chronicled the experience of Black female domestic workers and is known for creating an entire body of work that academics now reference around Black female domestic workers.
It was remembering these names? Are you reading them off your phone?
Like, I don't know. I have my notes on my phone. You know, I do have my notes on my phone. No, I didn't know all of these women either. Yes, and I hope y'all take notes and write it down.
Yes, girl, this is a lot.
Apple iPhone, keep my notes. No, because I want you to know their names. The second woman, Morgan, was a woman named Claudia Jones. Claudia Jones was born in Trinidad, and she was an activist who emerged as one of the Communist Party's leading theorists on Black women's exploitation. We can't talk about the Sojourners for Truth and Justice without talking about the Communist Party and even giving a little bit of context, which, of course, is starting in the 1930s, there was the New Deal, which you have talked about many times, way better than I could talk about. But there was an effort by the New Deal to drive economic recovery. It had a dirty little secret that everybody knew, which was in order for President Roosevelt to get support in the South, he had to water down the relief efforts of Black people in order to get the New Deal passed in the South. People weren't even supporting it or going for it because they felt like it gave too much to Black people. And as part of that time, Morgan, was also then the rise of the Communist Party in the United States. And a lot of it, the Black people came out of the New Deal feeling specifically disgruntled by what was happening. And the Communist Party appealed to them because they were made a point of organizing in the streets here in the United States against racism, inadequate relief, unemployment. And Black people didn't see any other organizations essentially who were internationally organizing and considering and keeping their rights in mind. So a lot of Black people, Angela Davis being one of them, were oriented towards the what was happening with the Communist Party. Some people were like, in fact, actually, the Communist Party were the people who on the ground, like you could actually call when it was like your eviction notice came, right? So there was activism and there was organizing. And then there was like, who I'm going to call when I actually need some rent money? Who I'm going to call when my landlord is actually doing something? And there was the League of Struggles, which was a Communist Party, and the International Labor Defense, which was a Communist Party. And those Communist parties were organizing on behalf of Black people in the United States, and the women who were a part of the Sojourners for Truth and Justice were major players in that work. The biggest
and most important voice was in the Communist Party for a while, and it was his wife.
That's exactly right. The biggest organizer of the Sojourners for Truth and Justice, and she was kind of like the main figurehead and the strategist behind it, was a woman. First of all, her middle name is Alone, and I can't stop thinking about why that was her middle name. I have no idea, but I'm just thinking about it. Her name was Louise Alone Thompson Patterson, and she was an activist. She was an educator. She was born in Chicago. After Chicago, she actually moved around the West.
That is like the first camp I ever heard of.
It is. It's sad, but we have to know. It's sad, but it's the crazy part that we don't know this stuff. I'm sorry and y'all feel sad, but you have to know this stuff.
It's literally the saddest story of Black history. Like, from the people who got killed, to the mama by the bedside, to the bass player with that sad poem. Like, I was just like,
Bea, yeah, it's her name. Yeah, B.
Yes, Bea's poem. B's poem. But we do our trainings and we ask women to make eye contact with another woman. There, inevitably, something happens. Either they are totally dialed into themselves and they can just look another woman in the eye and just feel the moment, or they immediately start crying, or they immediately start crying. Okay. And so when that lady was doing the poem, I was so glad I was on mute, because I was like, this is too much eye contact for today. I was just laughing so hard. I was like, the poem was so
And in the video, she's crying. I can't wait. There's an actual video, and she her tears are welling. It's too much for you to make eye contact with.
Eye contact makes you either cry,
or look away,
or laugh, or laugh. And I'm saying it was an inappropriate guffaw that I was laughing because it's too hard to say, white woman, we know you. You made us use our breath for your baby. It's just like, either you, because it's too hard to hold that every day. And to then have to walk among, people got to go back to work. You understand what I mean? Like, it's, this is like what trauma feels like. And sometimes laughing is the only outlet. You understand what I mean? Yeah. It's like Maya Angelou, when she reads We Wear the Mask, and then she just starts laughing. You know what I'm just saying?
Right.
That's how I'm feeling. After reconstruction yesterday, oh, I forgot to tell y'all something. I sent this to Vanessa late last night. So when you were just talking about the New Deal and how it was all an economic system to try to get America on its feet. Well, y'all know Reconstruction was what we talked about yesterday with the Freedmen's Bureau. It was just a whole economic policy so the North could prove that America could function as an industrial society. So the Freedmen's Bureau, for all the good stuff they did some shady stuff. And one of the shady things that the Freedmen's Bureau did, because they were a government bureau that was set into the South to recover the economy of the South with 4 million Black people who had been free. One of the things they did, talk about truth and justice for Black women, is they forced Black women onto the indentured sharecropping contract with their husbands. What are you talking about, Morgan? I'm talking about when you free the enslaved people, Abraham Lincoln, the first thing our men want to do is let us have a seat. We've been out there working like a man for our entire life out in the field. Our kids out there working like a grown man their whole life. The first thing a Black man want to do is be like, baby, you free. Go sit down. I got this farming. I got this. You can go raise our kids. You can teach them how to read. You know what I mean? And I'm not trying to double down on those gender roles. Do not write me. I'm just saying we have been out there from our culture here on the West Coast of Africa where I'm standing today. There was a division of labor. And I'm saying, and it wasn't us all doing the same stuff, us out there backbreaking labor. So Black women wanted to sit down. Well, the Freedmen's Bureau came out and was like, no, if your wife is not working out on that sharecropping field, considered a vagrant, she is illegal, and we will arrest her and put her in our prison chain gang. So by force, Black women could not rest or even take any domestic roles or even take the role that lady described in talking about I Know White Woman. We didn't even have the opportunity to sit on the porch and drink no lemonade. We couldn't even have one cup of lemonade. The Freedmen Bureau come in and talk about I got to get on the work contract with my husband or I'm a vagrant. I'm saying that ignorant. We never got a chance to rest or to be divinely feminine or to be women or to be or to just let our men never got a chance to just get out there and like earn for us. It was just so destructive legislatively.
And
I told my dad this yesterday. And I told my dad that yesterday. My dad is functionally illiterate. He went to school until he's 9 years old. Because guess what? When his dad died, he had to go out and do that contract for the sharecropper. So my grandmother and all of her kids had to fulfill that contract. When my grandfather, Booker T. Morgan, died, they had to fulfill that contract. I'm trying to tell y'all that this labor stuff we're doing for somebody else's economic gain has been a setup from the beginning. It's been a setup from the beginning. So when you were asking me about work-life balance the other day, do less. I don't believe the work-life balance when you're being exploited as a laborer. I don't believe in that concept. I barely believe in self-care. Add radical in front of it, and then I do believe it. But I'm saying do less, y'all. Say no. Do less. That's what I'm saying. So that's why I had to laugh at the poem, because it's overwhelming. I mean, it's a beautiful poem, and it was, like, very serious. I was just like, boy. And then when you was like, that lady's middle name was Alone, I was like, Vanessa. Black history, but go ahead, come on. I'm learning.
It's good. Louise Alone Thompson. No, everything you said, it's all, there's one story we're telling here, which is the beauty of Black History Bootcamp. It's not a linear story. It's a story that has as many twists and turns as Black, you know, because that's who Black people are, by the way. And our story has lots of twists and it has lots of turns, and it's all so connected. It's why I'm confident that the story is going to be victorious in the end. I really am. And I believe that Louise Alone Thompson, who we're talking about today, is even in our walking is being rebirthed. Like, even in this story, which I know is sad, I think we're giving her a new life and a new identity, and maybe even bringing some humanity to these women who I think are just known for like their struggle and their work. And just to know that her middle name is Alone is maybe even a piece of information that just humanizes her a little bit to people. So Louise Alone, though, I'm not going to call her that, but Louise Thompson was one of the first Black women, Morgan, to enroll at the University of California, Berkeley, and is actually at UC Berkeley, where she heard an inspirational lecture from W.E.B. Du Bois. And that lecture from W.E.B. Du Bois completely changed her life. And in 1923, after she graduated from Berkeley, she went down south and taught at Arkansas State College. And then she went to Hampton Institute and she taught there. And it was there where she was teaching that she supported a student revolt against the policies of the white administration at the time, because this was when it was the Hampton Institute in Virginia. And she was fired. They basically were like, you're backing student-led uprisings. And so she had to leave Hampton. Well, don't worry. She left Hampton. This was like 1927, exactly. Now, she graduated from Berkeley in 1923, and then it was in 1927 that she was at Hampton. She was dismissed from Hampton for supporting the student uprisings. She then ended up going to New York City, where she attended the New School, became a researcher, started working with the Urban League, and then it was... Exactly. No, you have no idea what I'm getting ready to even say. She actually founded the Vanguard, a group called the Vanguard Group, and she founded it in her Harlem apartment, the famed Sugar Hill apartment complex at 409 Edgecombe Avenue. And her apartment...
You know who used to live in that apartment complex?
Go ahead, tell them.
Mom and Dad.
I didn't know that. I thought you were going to say something. I did not know that.
No, they met in the Sugar Hill on Edgecombe, and she was a preschool teacher, and she used to, you know, Bumpy Johnson, the biggest drug dealer in all of Harlem history. He used to pick her up in the car, her Eloise. Yeah, I'm saying all this is connected, y'all. That's legendary in Harlem. Yeah.
No, yeah, and her apartments, Morgan, was one of the apartments where the Niggerati was known to actually meet and gather for music and readings. And that's why 3 years after she moved to New York, she married writer Wallace Thurman,
who we talked about
with the Thurman. Now, their marriage only lasted
Black
6 months.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He wrote the Black.
Yeah,
the
they were only married for 6 months.
Because he had a troubled childhood.
Yes, he had other issues of waiting. We're going to get into that today. After she was married to Wallace Thurman, though, Morgan, that's when actually she got heavily involved in the Communist Party. And she actually founded the Harlem chapter of the Friends of the Soviet Union, which was a group of Black people who even went to Moscow, and they made a film on the Black experience in the U.S. because the Communist Party was actually funding stories to be told and encouraging the story of what was happening at the Black experience in the United States to be told. And I want people to keep in mind, by the way, I'm actually surprised it's not more of a world strategy for countries that actually are coming against the United States to be like, okay, but country that keeps trying to come over here and tell us about democracy, look what's happening in your own streets. Okay, country that's coming over here and like trying to call the kettle black, look at what's happening. Like, essentially, and the Communist Party like agree or disagree.
It happened everywhere. It happened in Vietnam, where all of the Black soldiers in Vietnam were kind of converted over into the struggle of people of color around the world. So no, it continues to happen. It's a different kind of ethnic antagonism where you take the weakness of your opponent, which in this case is civil rights for America, and shine it back onto them. It's what Cuba did.
That's right.
It's what Fidel Castro did. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Louise actually stayed in the Soviet Union, Morgan, for 6 years. She returned to New York City, and she immediately helped Langston Hughes establish...
That's why she called herself Alone.
Yeah, people called her a Bohemian. I know. Well, people referred to her as like a Bohemian world traveler. She traveled all sorts of places. And actually, for a woman of her time of that era, it was kind of like unheard of for her to be traveling in the way that she was. But when she came back to the United States.
But she was also with Jordan Hurston. I mean, they had to be in the same apartment most of the time. And she also traveled around the world like this. But from an anthropological standpoint, not from a political standpoint. Yeah, that's fascinating.
Right.
Are there pictures of her?
There are some pictures of her. Yes, there are pictures of her. We can post some on our social media. There's pictures of her. When she came back to New York, Morgan, she helped Langston Hughes start the Harlem Suitcase Theater, which featured productions by Langston Hughes and other Black playwrights and all Black cast. She also became active in the defense fund that overturned the convictions of the Scottsboro Boys in Alabama, if you know about that case. And that case actually was heavily funded also there to overturn their conviction by people in the Communist Party. She eventually remarried a prominent communist attorney. His name was William Patterson. And they, along with Shirley Graham Du Bois, who we're going to talk about in a minute, and another woman, Charlotta Bass, who we're going to talk about, helped establish the Sojourners for Truth and Justice. So who are these other two important women that I want to talk about really quickly? There's Shirley Graham Du Bois, and I loved learning about her because I did know that she was the wife of W.E. Du Bois, but I didn't know that much about her own powerful past. She was one of five children. She was born in Indiana. Her father was a very well-known AME minister. Again, these things are all connected. And her family moved around because of her father's ministry. She actually even, for some reason, just I like because I'm from there, but her and Louise Townsend spent time in Seattle. And Shirley actually graduated from a high school in Spokane, Washington. She was married before W.E.B. Du Bois. I love this part of it too, because sometimes it don't be working out. But her first husband's name was Shadrach. And she actually moved to France. Right. Shut up.
I wish I had known you were doing this because I think she's married. With W.B. Du Bois.
She's in Ghana. She's in Ghana. Exactly.
Yeah,
that's
she's buried here. And that's not even a mile away. I should have walked over there and paid for it. Should I try?
So you should try. Because let me tell you about her story, Morgan, so you know why you should try. First of all, she moved to France after her first marriage and studied music at the Sorbonne. She was a musical genius, and she was able to send money back home, by the way, and support her children. It was in Paris where actually she started meeting a lot of Africans and African Caribbeans, and they like really expanded her taste around music. She came back to the United States and was like, done with you, Shadrach. This ain't working for me. And she actually went to Howard University, Morgan, and she became the music librarian at Howard University. And she studied under a super famous professor there, whose name I can't think of, who was a musical professor there. And he recommended her for a teaching position at Morgan College, which she went on to. And then she went on to Oberlin College. And it was while she went on Oberlin College. It was while she was at Oberlin College where she actually met W.E.B. Du Bois. She also composed a very famous opera called Tom Tom. It was a musical about the Negro experience, and it eventually was commissioned at the Stadium Opera House, and it featured an all-Black cast and orchestra, and it featured indigenous African tribes and drums, and it was one of the first operas that combined opera music with traditional African drums and the story of the African tribes. And the actual score for the musical was totally lost after the debut and never heard of again until in 2001 a researcher at Harvard found a copy in like one of their archives, and then I think it was eventually revived, which I just love.
Oh, that's so cool. Yeah,
I know.
I don't know if you've ever seen pictures of them together, but they were strong. W.B. Du Bois and his wife was strong, you know?
Yep.
They was like, you know, he would be like sitting on the velvet couch and he'd be looking at them. Like, you know, his museum here has like, I think one of her dresses. And it's funny because I was over there during one of the Black History Boot Camps a couple of seasons ago, and they have a new director over there. And I was in, I don't know how I got connected. Somebody connected us with him. And I was in there, and he was in the main house where W.E.B. Du Bois lived. And he's talking. He's like, well, you know, we need to help this. You know, you want to help us, you know, fundraise, be on the board, whatever. I was like, no, brother, I got to not do that. Just like, but he was just like, But then I couldn't pay attention because I was like, are you sitting in W.D. Du Bois' living room? I was just like, and then Vanessa, you know me, I was like, but see, girl, check out the office right here in the back corner of me. Like, yeah, I'm gonna do some work, but we couldn't do that quid pro quo. But I should maybe go back. Maybe we do need some office space over there, actually. We have to go back.
Did
but,
you?
But it was just so fascinating sitting in that man's actual house where, you know, they was like hugged up and stuff and like just like.
Did you know he was 83 when she married him, when he married her and she was 54?
54?
Yep, she was 54 years old. That's what I'm saying. This woman had a life. Like, I love this because all I knew about her was that she was W. Du Bois' wife. But she, when I'm checking, I'm like, no, actually, she was a famous musician. She studied at the Sorbonne. She had another man. She led the music department at Howard University. She taught at Oberlin.
That's
and
why
then,
yes,
and then at 54 years old. And did you know she was expelled? She was forced to leave Ghana. She actually left when there was the military coup in 1966. And she moved to Cairo, Egypt with her son, who was, I think, from her first marriage. And she actually lived in Cairo for a really long time before returning.
Well, because they were friends with Kwame Nkrumah. And Kwame Nkrumah got expelled during the coup. And his wife was from Egypt.
I did not know that part.
Yeah. His daughter is here too. I just saw her at the beauty. I was like the lip bar. They have one, something like that. I just saw her. But yeah.
Yeah. Well, no, that's super interesting. So she ended up, she lived to be 80 years old and she died of breast cancer. She was actually living in China at the time and died as a Tanzanian citizen, which is one of the places that she actually ended up going to after Ghana. But there's two other there's two other women who I also want to talk about really quickly. So we have Louisa, powerful woman. We now know her story, married to Wallace Thurman. These women were dope. Like, I'm talking about a crew of women who rallied Lorraine Hansberry and Mary Church Terrell and was like, let's go to Washington, D.C., where they did all this work. But to know who they were is a power. There was another woman, Morgan, who I'll just tell you briefly about. Her name was Charletta Spears Bass, and she was a newspaper publisher who they recruited into the movement. And she was the first Black woman to own and operate a newspaper in the United States. And it was the California Eagle, and the California Eagle was published from 1912 to 1951. And she even actually was the first Black woman, I don't think people know this, who was nominated for the vice presidential candidate of the United States as a candidate under the Progressive Party. So they got Charletta, they got Louisa, they got Lorraine Hansberry, who was only 21 years old at the time. And they also got, Morgan, I know you... I want to think about this, what this book was called. Do you know the book, A Hero Ain't Nothing But a Sandwich?
Yes.
Thank you. I'm so glad you said yes. Alice Childress, the woman who I asked you about at the beginning.
Oh, I knew her name. Yeah. Yep. No, I knew.
So,
and I do know Alice Childress's wife at this point. I just don't know their names, and that's why this is an important episode.
It is why it's so important. So Alice Childress, I loved A Hero Ain't Nothing But a Sandwich. It came out in like 1973, but if you're a child of like the 80s or the 90s, it probably was a book that you were able to find in your school library. She's a young adult novelist, and she was known for like
Vanessa,
confronting...
Vanessa, you're a child of the 70s.
I'm a child of the 80s and the 90s.
Okay.
I don't know what you're talking about.
But I'm just saying, that was that... That book was like them orange 70s coats.
It was. And I like stuff like that. It really, 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 really was. It was.
I'm just saying, tell the people, speak your truth. That's all I'm saying. Speak your truth, girl, in these streets. Let it resound.
I was. Yes, and that's why I loved Alice Childress. And when I found out that she was one of these original founders, I loved it. So Alice Childress, who was a young adult novelist and a playwright herself, you had Lorraine Hansberry, you had the first Black woman to start a newspaper in the United States. And it was Louise who, after hearing that poem, she first got Bay. It was her and Bay. And they went to her apartment and then they wrote that manifesto that I was reading from earlier.
Manifesto. Yeah,
it is. And then they had this call to action where they said, everybody come here to Washington, D.C. So 140 women showed up in Washington, D.C. First, they went to the house of Frederick Douglass and they held a rally there. And it was at that rally that Lorraine Hansberry, she read some of the manifesto. And she talked about, one of the things that people noted is that she talked about Black women as wives and mothers. And it was one of it, and people said it sounds small, but it was essential because people were continuously trying to dehumanize Black women. And so she intentionally was talking about them in that vantage point so that people and so that people understood that they were coming not even as political activists, but as wives and mothers. And they said that this was that their demand and their proclamation wasn't a petition, but it, a petition around anything other than their expected rights of citizenship. And they wanted people to understand that, that they were full citizens of this United States of America, that they were mothers and wives, and that they were demanding the rights by which they deserved as other mothers and wives, which goes back to the poem that inspired what they were doing, Bay, because they were like, if we are able to actually juxtapose this white women framing themselves consistently as like the wives and the mothers and the people who need and like forgetting us, then we'll be able to have some traction. While they were there in Washington, D.C., they had a silent vigil that they held on the lawn of the White House. They met with the Justice Department. They met with several major players in the White House who then did not, by the way, immediately start to change action on them. It was over a decade later that we had the March on Washington. But what did happen, Morgan, is the establishment of the kind of feminist framework and other organizing that we've talked about so deeply in Black History Bootcamp. A lot of that came out of that original manifesto and this very small gathering of women, 140 women who came to Washington, D.C. in 1951 to demand their rights.
Wow. Well, that was a lot.
It was a lot.
I love the story.
Thank you.
I think it was really, I think it was important. Let's close it out and we can decide after.
Let's close it out. Yep. We're going to close it out with a song by Rose Royce and the Pointer Sisters. So this is upbeat because regardless of the hardships of the story, if these women hadn't done the work they did, Girl Trek wouldn't be here today. And so much of their manifesto is a part of our manifesto, even in so many ways. And so I feel inspired by the work that they did and still hopeful that we will be able to, on behalf of these women, claim justice and joy for ourselves. So let's end on this note, which is You Gotta Believe by Rose Royce and the Pointer Sisters.